Hello everyone, and welcome back for a new episode of the Botch Deeper podcast. I'm your host, Luke Morgante, and in today's episode, we speak with Mark Landry, who serves as the Marshall Plan Endowed Professor in Austrian Studies and Director of Center Austria at the University of New Orleans. The conversation explores topics from his new book, Mountain Battery, the Alps, Water, and Power in the Fossil Fuel Age, which covers the development of hydropower in the Alps through the fall of the Habsburg monarchy to the rise of National Socialism and the eventual impact of American influence after World War I. Enjoy. Hello, Mark. Thank you for being on the Botch Deeper podcast, and congratulations on the recent release of your new book.
Thank you, Luke. I'm really happy to be here.
I was wondering to start off if you could give our listeners a little bit of a background on yourself. I saw that you are originally from Vermont, but now have spent quite a while in New Orleans at the University of New Orleans, and a lot of your work has connected to the country of Austria. So I was hoping you could give us a little clarity on how those connections came to be and how they culminated in this book.
Sure. Well, yes, yeah, so I'm an environmental historian of modern Europe, and I direct Center Austria at the University of New Orleans. And Center Austria is one of nine so-called Austrian centers worldwide that are sponsored by the Austrian government, and they all have a little bit of roles and histories and missions, but in general, it's supposed to facilitate exchange between Austria and the host country or location and spread knowledge about Austria, Austrian history, culture, and studies. And yes, you said I'm from Vermont originally. I'm from Colchester, Vermont. I was born and raised there. And that's in the northwestern part of the state on a big lake called Lake Champlain. And you know, my path to Austria and becoming an environmental historian, they're all connected a little bit, but, and also with UNO. As an undergraduate, I knew that I wanted to try to learn German and to study abroad a little bit because I thought that eventually I would like to go into the history of the German-speaking world. I had that idea already as an undergraduate that that could be a career path. And I was looking for programs, study abroad programs, and my advisor actually mentioned that the University of New Orleans had a program in Innsbruck, Austria, at the University of Innsbruck. They had a study abroad program for a semester or for a year, and that really intrigued me because being a Vermonter, I liked snow and I liked skiing, and the thought of being in the Alps, learning German there, but also getting to ski a little bit really excited me. So that was the first time I'd heard of the University of New Orleans, and I became part of this program, and that was just probably the most formative experience for me as an undergraduate. It was getting to study abroad. I ended up staying in Innsbruck for a year, learning the language, learning to read, but also immersing myself in another culture. And that really opened my eyes to see how things could be done differently in a different place. And that was actually where I also got the idea and the interest in environmental history, because living directly in the mountains in Innsbruck, you become aware of how the mountains affect day-to-day life. The weather is an obvious reason, but that's when I started to think that it would be interesting to do history that took account of geography, that took account of ecological processes in explaining how things have happened in the past. And I ended up at Georgetown University for my PhD, and it was there that I really learned that there's this discipline called environmental history, a newer, I would say, type of history, method of history that really tries to take in account the natural world in explaining human history, that tries to tell history as if nature existed. So all of these things are connected, and it just so happened that when I had finished my PhD and was on the job market, that a job opened up here at UNO in New Orleans to come and be associate director of Center Austria. Günter Bischoff, who was the longtime director, was advertising a job for an associate director. So I jumped at that chance, and that's how I ended up down here in New Orleans. And it's that was 2017, so we've been here for quite some time now.
And as you began your own connection with Austria and the history of the United States and Austria and the connection with Center Austria and New Orleans. How did your perception of Austria change? How do you view the country nowadays? And what do Americans maybe not realize about Austria that is apparent to you?
Wow, that's a really great question and interesting one. I guess I'll start with thinking about myself as an American prior to having come to Austria for the first time to Innsbruck and then getting to see the rest of the country and maybe Americans in general. You know, we think of a few things. I think we think of music, Mozart, Sound of Music, the mountains come to a lot of people's mind. Maybe people know a little bit about Vienna. But having lived there and having studied the history of the place for a few years, you of course learn that the country is so much more than the stereotypes or, you know, the icons that we're all familiar with. And, you know, my experience has been a little bit different. I think a lot of people that come to Austria to study it as an academic, they come to it through Vienna, because Vienna, obviously the capital and the large city, and it just has a certain attraction, a gravitational pull. But my focus ever since I started with the UNO program has been in the western part, in the mountainous part. So I've really sort of delved into the history of that landscape. And yeah, what I would say is, in terms of what I've learned, something that really interested me, and I guess that's a part of the research that I've been doing. You know, I wrote a book that really tried to be about Alpine history, to look at the history of this landscape that is not just in one country, but transcends international borders, is that we can actually see that in this similar environment, a lot of the different countries and societies that are at home in the Alps made pretty similar decisions, in this case, about building dams and building infrastructure in the Alps to create energy. And so that was something I thought that is an interesting finding. And I don't want to say that there weren't different particularities depending on which country. Of course, all of that mattered, and the different histories of the places I studied mattered. But that this common environment actually led to what I would call broadly similar solutions and broadly similar histories. I thought that was something interesting that I learned about Austria through my research. So yeah, I mean, it's really, I guess I can just only emphasize that Austria is such a varied country for being so small. When I say so small, I think it's about the size of the state of Maine in terms of land area. It contains a really diverse set of landscapes, very diverse regions with their own very long histories as well. And so that to really understand Austria, you have to understand that it's a diverse place. There's a lot of difference throughout the country.
I think that was a great explanation. And your point about the various ideas that come to mind for people when they think of Austria, hydropower and the Alps isn't necessarily one of the immediate answers. So with your book, Mountain Battery, The Alps, Water and Power in the Fossil Fuel Age, that recently came out, focusing on the development of hydropower and its significance in the region. What about that story stood out to you, and why do you feel it was an important story to tell?
Yeah, so I think that's right. In general, this book that I've written, you know, I do environmental history, but within environmental history, there have been, in recent years especially, a growing group, I would say, of people who are specifically interested in energy history. How different societies have gotten the energy that they needed to function, what have been the environmental impacts of that energy use, and particularly for people looking at the modern period, these are really important questions, because it's been energy use, above all fossil fuel use, that has created some of our most challenging environmental problems, particularly global warming, the burning of fossil fuels, and the greenhouse effect are leading to a situation where humans are having an enormous impact on our global environment. In fact, maybe the most important driver of global environmental processes. So energy is really at the core, at the foundation of these changes. And so there's a group interested in sort of trying to study how that came to be. How did we become, in some parts of the world, such energy intensive society? So that I was interested in energy, and having lived in the Alps, you know, one thing that I became aware of, and I actually, you know, this is a sort of, it might sound like a joke, but probably the first time I really was aware of it is I was skiing in the Alps that first year that I was there. I was doing a ski tour, which is where you walk up the mountain using skins. So you have your skis on, you walk up, and then you ski down. And we walked past a gigantic reservoir. And so this was, you know, a reservoir in the mountains to store water, particularly for energy purposes. And I think one thing that I did learn, to go back to your previous question, that I didn't know about the Alps is actually throughout the Alps, in Austria in particular, but all over, so much water is being used for energy purposes. And there's so many dams that have been built at high altitude. And you don't get to see those unless you really get up into the higher areas. And in fact, you know, if you've seen an alpine lake anywhere, chances are that it somehow has been modified in order to help produce electricity. Just about every lake has been changed in some way. And so that's when I thought, okay, this is a story that people don't know. I was not aware of it myself, but the Alps, in fact, have been and continue to be one of the most important energy producing landscapes in Europe. An enormous amount of electricity is produced there every year. And so that's what I thought I would do. Okay, this combines all of my interests. I would like to tell the history of this energy landscape of the Alps, which I call Mountain Battery. And I want to explain why it is that the Alps became this important energy landscape, what that can tell us both about our energy use, our ideas about nature, but also, you know, how that impacted the history of Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries. And then finally, I wanted to be able to explain how the changes that have been made in order to harness this energy, to build dams, to reroute rivers, how that's affected the European environment. Because essentially what has happened over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, I argue, is that by building these dams, Europeans, Austrians included, transformed the Alps into a giant natural battery, a giant landscape specifically designed to store energy to be used when human societies wanted to. So what you have is basically a story of human societies massively intervening into environmental processes, the hydrological cycle, whereby water falls on the mountain and then makes its way out to the seas, eventually to be evaporated and sent back up and continue over and over again. What has happened is Europeans have massively intervened in this cycle in order to be able to get energy. And, you know, the primary way that they did this was by building dams. One statistic that I came across that really sort of staggers me is, you know, if you measured the volume of concrete that have been poured into the Alps in order to create these dams, you would have a volume that's several times greater than the volume that was used for the Great Pyramids in Egypt. An engineer in the Alps was sort of bragging about this achievement. And so you can kind of say this is a wonder in some ways, a technological wonder, what's been done in the Alps. That pyramid comparison maybe isn't so wrong. But to get back to your question, you know, this is sort of why I got interested, is because I don't think it's well known that the Alps are used in this way. And I also think there are connections between the energy that was created in the Alps in the 19th and 20th century and broader European history that not a lot of people are aware of either. So it basically, by looking at the history of this landscape and a story that was not well known, this would be a way to tell a new history of Europe, a new history of Austria and the other Alpine countries.
I would like to ask you next how this story begins in Austria, how the idea of harnessing the Alps as a mountain battery, as you say, began. But a note to that point, you mentioned in the book that the push for hydropower and developing this energy source kind of came about when the Industrial Revolution was taking place and societies started requiring much higher amounts of energy. And it reminded me of the concept of environmental determinism, basically saying that society is shaped or forms, at least in part, by the environment it is a part of. And in this case, it seems kind of like technological determinism in some way. I guess my question would be, how did this drive for hydropower in the Alps begin? And how much of it was a result of the Industrial Revolution driving the need for energy?
Well, yeah, I think you get immediately at a really crucial idea here and question. So yes, I would say broadly speaking, it's industrialization that creates the conditions where making hydroelectricity out of alpine water is possible. And so the way that I try to put it in the book, it's there in the title already. The title is Mountain Battery, the Alps, Water, and Power in the Fossil Fuel Age. I argue, and I believe along with several other historians, that really sort of a fundamental turning point in the history of humanity, but definitely, you know, the human economy, is when around the year 1800, countries first start using fossil fuels intensively, and in particular talking about coal. So there's a lot of discussion about when this really happened, but, you know, a simple way to think about it is around 1800 in Great Britain, particularly in England, that country began to use fossil fuels in its industry and its industrial revolution far more intensively than any region of the earth had to that point. And the reason that this is so fundamental is because fossil fuels are basically like winning the energy lottery. It's basically stored sunshine from millions of years ago, the remnants of dinosaurs and old forests that have accumulated over time. And they contain coal and oil, fossil fuels in general, contain really, really concentrated stores of energy that don't require any specific land to be devoted to it. So forests also contain energy, but you have to grow them. And that takes time, and you have to set aside land for that. And land that's being used for forests can't be used for other things like crops, which are another form of energy, right? Fossil fuels are like an energy windfall. The problem is, you can only use them once and then they're gone. But when Britain began to use these fossil fuels intensively, it gave them enormous advantages economically in terms of their industrial power. It gives countries enormous military advantages. If you have locomotives and steam engines, you get huge advantages in transportation. So that this transition to fossil fuels that, let's say, happened around 1800, that this new age, it really creates pressure all over the world for other societies to try to find either their own fossil fuel resources or some other energy that can help them compete economically and militarily. And so what I kind of argue in the early part of this book is that it's this advent of the fossil fuel age that changes the way people look at water coming out of the Alps. Prior to 1800, water was used for energy purposes in the form of mills. You would definitely have both industrial mills in the Alps and also ones used for creating flour, for bread, and for agricultural purposes. But in large part, it was viewed as a nuisance, as something that caused destruction through flooding and so forth. But it's in the mid-19th century, in places like France, but also Austria, people began to look at this and buy a new opportunity to harness energy and lots of energy for industrial purposes. And one French engineer coined the term white coal to talk about water streaming down from the white peaks of the Alps. And this became a very popular way to think about alpine water, that it had the possibility of changing economies and societies the same way that coal had. And so a larger argument in the book is, you know, our energy systems influence the way that we perceive our environment. So it would not have been possible to see white coal in the Alps unless we had entered this new energy era that was dominated by fossil fuels. But as you said, with industrialization came the idea that alpine water might be used in this way. And France and Switzerland were pioneers in some ways of building hydroelectric plants high up in the Alps. But of course, it was happening in Austria as well. In those early decades of electrification, you know, we're thinking about the 1880s, 90s, really up until the beginning of the First World War. There are also dams being built in the Austrian Alps. But at that time, Austria is part of Austria-Hungary, a large multinational empire, and one that actually had regions with quite a lot of coal resources, Bohemia in particular. And so in Austria-Hungary, there wasn't as much pressure to really exploit alpine water power until after the First World War, when Austria-Hungary collapses and Austria emerges as basically the German-speaking areas of Austria-Hungary. And so that points right there a little bit to a question that you had raised, these ideas of environmental and technological determinism, right? That because the Alps existed and their mountains, it was almost inevitable that they would be used in this way. Or because we had industrial technology that would allow us to create electricity, to build large dams, to transport the electricity, that it's almost inevitable that it would be utilized in this way. And there's definitely something to that, I would say. You have pressures, but I think what a lot of historians want to do is push back on any idea of inevitability in history and sort of point out the ways that things might have been different, that they could have gone differently, particularly with the technological determinism, the point that you raised there. You know, one huge turning point, probably the most important turning point in the story of the Alps as an energy landscape, is the First World War. That if this conflict had not happened when it did in the manner that it did, I think we would have seen a completely different story regarding energy use in the Alps, because it's really the First World War that creates a crisis situation throughout Europe and a huge need, a huge demand for energy, obviously, to fight the war. But then in the wake of the war, it completely redraws the map of Europe and creates in the Eastern Alps, Austria, a smaller country that would rely on that power for its own economic well-being. But also it created an atmosphere within the countries, this belief that for the security of the nation, energy sources would have to be developed in an intensive way, that they had to be developed in a large scale. So, you know, the story of white coal prior to 1914 is quite different than the one after 1914. And I think the Second World War is similar in some ways in terms of creating a post-war period where the pressures to gain new energy sources were really great. So I think those are really interesting points that you make. But as I said, I think historians like to always show that history is never really preordained to one sort of development or not. It might look like that in retrospect, but if we really look at the events, we can always find these moments when things might have been quite different.
It's such an interesting story, especially I think looking back from today's perspective. I mean, when I was growing up and going to school, so much of science class would be talking about alternative energy sources and how they could help combat global warming. So I never really thought of the development of something like hydropower as being compelled by Austria losing its energy resources after World War I and needing to find an alternative, that being the Alps. How efficient was white coal in replacing those fossil fuels at the time? And how did it reshape the Austrian energy infrastructure and economy after World War I?
Yeah, great question. And I think, you know, that's another argument I want to make in the book, or theme anyway, is generally we sort of divide between fossil fuels and renewables. And obviously there's good reasons to do that and sort of to separate them. But I try to emphasize that in many ways, they're all connected. A place that does not necessarily have a lot of, like Austria prior to 1914, that hadn't yet really exploited much of its water power resources. That was because there was abundant coal. And so in that society, in that economy, there wasn't the same pressure. And, you know, in the interwar years, so between World War I and World War II, there is a huge jump in the amount of white coal being harnessed. And that is in many ways because people saw Alpine water power as the best way to conserve coal resources. So if you could create this new energy source, this new source of electricity, then things that people had previously used coal for, well, you could substitute this, right? And then you would have coal for different and more essential economic purposes. So in some ways, it makes sense to think about them separately, particularly in terms of environmental impact, but we have to see this, their use all over as really inherently connected. That, yeah, they're really inherently connected. So in terms of efficiency, hydropower is a much more efficient energy than using fossil fuels. With fossil fuels, a huge amount of the energy that's contained either in oil or in coal is actually lost to humanity in the form of heat. It just dissipates in the burning process and serves no purpose for humans, right? We're not able to harness it. So in some ways, it's a very wasteful energy source, and the way that we use it is quite profligate. Renewable resources like hydro are much more efficient. We have built machines like turbines and generators that are able to extract much more of the original energy and useful energy out of it than we do with fossil fuels. Austria, during the interwar years, was somewhat successful in using hydropower, white coal from the Alps, to substitute and to replace coal. One way that they did this was they began to electrify some of the main railways in Austria. There was a law that basically stipulated these railroads should be switched over to electricity that we can get from hydropower, so that we don't have to buy expensive coal from abroad, particularly from Bohemia and Poland. So there was a program to electrify the rail lines. And by the end of the 1930s, almost all of the main railroads west of Salzburg in the Alps had been electrified. So that put Austria at that time period really at the forefront of the world in terms of electrifying their railroads, their passenger railroads. This was viewed as very modern at that time period. And of course, nowadays, you know, the bullet trains systems that exist all over the world are of course electrified. So, in this respect, we see an Austria that was really sort of at the vanguard, the cutting edge of a new technology because of its Alpine water power. But an issue with, you know, substituting hydropower for coal is that there's some things that coal is just way more convenient for, or fossil fuels, I should say as well, right? It's really fossil fuels, oil, that allows for the internal combustion engine that we need for automobiles. And of course, now we're working on electrified vehicles. And at the start of automobility, electric vehicles had been prevalent as well. But, you know, by the mid 20th century, automobiles were primarily powered by oil. And so it was difficult to use hydroelectricity and white coal for things like that. But that's, you know, probably the main argument that I make then in my book. The reason it's called Mountain Battery is because I found when researching that the energy experts who basically decided how the dams were going to be built, how the hydropower was going to be harnessed, because there are infinite possibilities how one might do that, right? An engineer can really let their imaginations go and design these dams, place these dams in really infinite places. But what was driving, particularly by the mid-1920s, what became the common view all over the Alps was that the Alps were special because they had places where you could store the water easily. So these were existing lakes, or they were mountain valleys where you could build a dam and store the water. And that this was really special because it allowed water power to act somewhat like coal. Coal, you know, as soon as you get it out of the ground, you can store it, transport it, and wherever you're able to set up a steam engine, you can have energy nearby. So it offered convenience and flexibility. Whereas water power traditionally had to be used where in the moment that it was generated, right? If the hydroelectricity is not utilized in that second where it's created, it is lost for the ages, right? And so this created problems. It wasn't as convenient. And now here's another place where people might have decided to do something different. We could have said, or Europeans could have said, hey, we have a lot more water power in the Alps available in the summer when the snow and the glaciers are melting. And we could just decide to do most of our economic activity during the summer. We could have our factories really running then, and we could take advantage of this. But the Europeans did not make that choice. They wanted to make water conform to their ideas about economy and society. They wanted it to be available when we wanted it. And so that's why storage becomes so important. That's where that idea mountain battery came from. And, you know, we know from today that batteries and energy storage are really continue to be a huge issue for energy, particularly as we try to add things like solar and wind into our grids. Solar and wind don't store unless you can store them in an actual battery, you know, an industrial battery. You can't really bottle up the wind and you can't store sunshine. Water among the renewables allows itself to be accumulated. And so the Alps were particularly unique and important in this regard.
If you could, because I'm not very familiar with the technology, I'm sure other people aren't. When I think of hydropower plants and such, I think of the Hoover Dam being the main one, this massive, massive project. As hydropower was being developed with the technology in the Alps, would that consist of very large projects that took a lot of time, or were there smaller hydropower plants that were being built around the mountains? Basically, how did the technology look? How did building it actually take place?
That's a great question. And what I show in the book is the Alps are at an advantage. This is another reason why I think it became this energy landscape in terms of the physics of hydropower. The energy that can be harnessed is basically a question of the amount of water that you can wrangle and the distance that you can get it to drop, right? So it's a simple multiplication. So how much volume and how much relief. Volume times relief, that is going to equal your energy bounty. And of course, what the Alps have then innately is relief. And in fact, an Austrian that I studied, he argued that relief, or, you know, the distance, the height of the mountains was almost an Austrian resource. I thought that was an interesting way to put it. But because there's so much relief in the Alps, what that means is you can get a comparatively little amount of water. As long as you can get it to fall greater distances, you will have a lot of energy. And so what this meant was that particularly early on, Alpine hydropower facilities could be quite small in comparison in terms of the amount of water that they harnessed, because they had those huge drops available, you know, in some cases over 2,000 meters at some points. So early on, Alpine white coal and hydropower facilities really could just consist of something very simple, an obstruction in a small creek or a small torrent that just diverted a piece of the water out of its bed to another spot where it could then be dropped down to the turbines below. So in this case, it wouldn't look like Hoover Dam. Hoover Dam, really tall dam, but it's on the main branch of a large river, the Colorado river. It's sort of a different situation. Now, after the 1920s and particularly after the Second World War, again, Europeans, Swiss, French, also the Austrians, Italians began to build dams that look something like the Hoover Dam that are 200, 300 meters in height and these massive concrete constructions. And I'll just tell you about one Austrian dam that I think is really interesting in this regard. Austrians will know about this very much, but it's not something I think most Americans think of. It's called Kaprun. And Kaprun, you can't really call it just a dam. It's a series of dams, a complex of dams in the Austrian Alps close to the city of Salzburg. And this project was completed in the post-war period. It was completed in 1955. And when it was, it basically had the same sort of role and function in Austrian society as the Hoover Dam did in the United States, right? It was seen as this amazing achievement, but for Austria in particular, it was sort of an act of reconstruction after the destruction of the Second World War. Interestingly, and we can talk about this maybe later, construction on the project began during the National Socialist period when Austria was a part of National Socialist Germany. About a third of it got built. But in the post-war period, with the help of Marshall Plan aid from the United States, the entire complex is finished. And what it does, the reason I'm mentioning it here, is it does not collect and harness the energy of one river like the Hoover Dam, which is damming up the Colorado and then using that energy. Kaprun actually takes water from an enormous range, essentially, of mountains within the Alps. The range is called the Hohe Tauern. This is where the tallest mountain in Austria is located. It takes and collects water from all of these high valleys and transports it via tunnel and via canal all to one valley, the Kaprun Valley, where it is collected behind these dams and then sent to the turbine. So the best way to think of Kaprun is not really the power of one river, but it's the power of an entire mountain range. And this type of power plant became common in the Alps after 1945. And one, I think, really staggering sort of thing about them, and Kaprun in particular, so the valley lies on the north side of the watershed in the Alps. Basically, on the north side, all of that water flows eventually into the Danube, and on the other side of that line of that watershed, all of the water eventually flows into the Adriatic Sea via some other rivers, right? But it really divides. It's a continental divide in some ways, and Kaprun, to build it and to give those dams more water, Austrian engineers drilled a tunnel underneath the watershed and sent the water from the south to the north. So they really rerouted the sources of these rivers and forced them to flow across a continental watershed. So great was the demand for energy after World War II.
It sounds like such incredible technology, especially with all of this happening in the early 1900s to the mid 1900s. You mentioned that the construction of the Kaprun Dam began during the Nazi period in Austria. Would you be able to elaborate on how the Anschluss and the rise of National Socialism in Austria played a role in the story of hydropower and its development?
Sure. And I think this is one area where, among historians, it's maybe not so well known, the role that Austria played, and especially the Alpine water power in Nazi energy planning and energy supplies. But I think in the course of my research, I also sort of came across ideas about this energy that changed the way I thought about National Socialism and its the way it got its energy and the sort of plans that it had to harness energy in connection with its expansion plans. So yes, I guess one way to start thinking about this is, you mentioned the word Anschluss, and maybe that's familiar to some listeners. You know, this is the German word that is used to refer to the annexation of Austria to National Socialist Germany that happened in 1938. They call it the Anschluss. And basic way to think about that translation, a simple translation would be connection. I think one thing that's not so well known is this connection of Austria to the state and country of Germany was not something that just happened in 1938, but really after the First World War, when Austria emerged from the wreckage of Austria-Hungary, most Austrians actually expected and wanted to be part of Germany after 1918. They wanted the Anschluss. That's how they spoke about it back then, too, because they thought that was the only way that Austria, the new remnant country, could be economically viable. And as part of the treaties ending the First World War, this was forbidden by the victorious Allies. It was expressly forbidden that Austria could join Germany then. But this is, you know, one sort of background and context for Hitler's eventual annexation of Austria in 1938, that there had been talk about this much earlier. And the reason I go into a little detail here is because Anschluss in German can also be used in the technical sense. And indeed, in the field of electrical engineering, when you talk about Anschluss, that means a connection, usually between different electricity grids. And so, you know, looking at the history of Alpine water power in Austria after the First World War and in the run-up to the Second, we can see that there were plans and indeed, in some ways, the Anschluss of Austrian white coal to Germany actually happened. So in the late 1920s, a large German utility, electrical utility in Western Germany, built and helped finance a huge dam in far Western Austria in Vorarlberg. And they built what was then the longest transmission line in Europe to send white coal north to the German industrial zone. And at that time, some people hailed this as sort of an electrical Anschluss, an electrical connection between Austria and Germany. And then there were other German utilities that wanted to build upon this. In the eastern part of Germany, they wanted their own connection to Austrian Alpine water power. And that was when the idea to build these dams in Kaprun really became discussed seriously. There were ideas and projects floating around, and they all end roughly in 1930 when the Great Depression really begins to take hold and the financing for such a large undertaking kind of disappears. But, you know, these plans and these ideas don't disappear. They stay in desk drawers. And with the takeover of the National Socialists in Germany, you know, the new experts there, energy experts, always have Austrian hydropower in their mind as they're thinking about the expansion of the German economy in the 1930s, the mobilization, right, preparing for military conflict that was kind of driving the German economy at this time. These experts are very aware of Austrian water power, of white coal, and they write memoranda saying, you know, there's vast amounts of energy here. For any future plans that we have, this is going to be critical. And so, you know, I'm able to show how in the run-up to 1938 and the annexation, there are these agencies within the German government that are really interested in having access to this white coal. So that in 1938, March of 1938, when the Anschluss finally happens, very immediately thereafter, Hermann Göring, who was really Hitler's second in command and in charge of the Austrian economy, he gives a big speech in a train station in Vienna, and he lists building dams in the Alps as one of the most important economic priorities for incorporating Austria into Germany. And so already in May 1938, so just a couple of months after the Anschluss, the centerpiece of these plans to build the dam complex in Kaprun, that breaks ground. And the National Socialists create an energy company, a state-owned energy company called the Alpine Electroworks, to carry out these dams and to other hydropower projects in Austria. So I guess I just want to kind of underline really, really quickly why this was so important for Germany, what the energy planners saw. And what they saw, they knew that Hitler was planning for war, potentially, and they compared themselves to places like Great Britain, to places like the United States, to places like the Soviet Union, that had either continents with vast resources or global empires that they could reach upon for energy resources. And they looked at Germany and saw that Germany was lacking in this regard. And what it particularly needed was coal to be used in other industrial processes. They needed coal to create synthetic fuel, right? Because Germany was lacking in oil resources of its own. And there's a process by which you can take coal, and with a lot of energy, you can turn that coal into hydrocarbons, into an oil, a synthetic oil. And the other thing that coal was really, really important for was synthetic rubber, to create synthetic rubber, which Germany did not have access to. It did not have global empires where it could get rubber as easily as say, Great Britain. And so hydropower, and particularly alpine hydropower, was seen as absolutely essential to substitute in place of coal in Germany, so that coal could be freed up for these other crucial uses. And particularly with the oil, we're talking about the German Air Force, that it needed large amounts of synthetic oil. So that was the role that Austria was supposed to play in their mind, that the Austrian Alps were supposed to create large amounts of electricity so that Germany could free up coal for these other critical war uses. Part of these plans was to eventually connect the Austrian Alps and the hydroelectricity being produced in the Austrian Alps to the industrial zone around Auschwitz, right? Because this was one of the main areas where synthetic materials were being produced. And by the end of the war, there is actually, they do succeed, the Nazis do succeed in creating an energy connection between Kaprun and Auschwitz. It's not on the scale that they envisioned, but this was, you know, this is just to sort of emphasize that there was a connection between this Austrian energy and German war planning, but also in terms of the Holocaust and the destruction of Europe's Jews.
Would you argue that their ambitions with white coal from the Alps were overambitious, or were they more justified in its potential to replace or at least supplement their energy needs otherwise?
This is a really good question, and I struggled with myself, trying to think about the connection between these plans to build large dams in Austria and the Alps and the other goals of the National Socialist regime and what that really reveals to us, what that can tell us. And I guess, you know, I would kind of go along with, I would say, a number of other historians who look at Nazi economic history and have basically concluded, you know, the idea to go to war against Great Britain, but then the United States and the Soviet Union all at once, that it was lunacy in many ways, just from a resource standpoint, right? To think that National Socialist Germany and the territories that it conquered, that it could compete with that kind of, against that, those enemies with those sorts of resource bases, that's it's sheer lunacy. So what I mean to say is I don't think, the probabilities, I think, concerning a war of Germany against those adversaries were always not in Germany's favor. But I think then that's what this story about what's going on in the Alps and the connection of Nazi Germany to them, it just underlines that lunacy, but also shows there's a complete mismatch between the plans to build these dams and the greater goals of the Nazi state. So, you know, to put a finer point on it, I guess it was probably a mistake to have an energy policy that was focused on building dams that would take 5 to 10 years to complete, and then to launch essentially a world war at the beginning of this period, right? That it's a complete misalignment of energy policy and foreign and military policy. But it also needs to be said that a lot of resources were spent on building these dams. And so that they too contributed, I would say, to the downfall of the Nazi economy and also to its military defeat in some way, right? On the other hand, the energy was needed. It was required for German remobilization and for its war economy. And really, Austria was one of the most obvious places where additional energy could be harnessed. So it's a very tricky question, but I think it just, at the end of the day, it just underlines the lunacy of National Socialist policy. One thing I say that was sort of new to me, or I thought about it in different ways, is for German economic historians, it's well known that when Albert Speer takes over as munitions minister, he actually implements what's called a crash program for thermal energy, because the Nazi economy required large amounts of electricity to continue to supply its armies, and it needed this quick. So he implements this crash program, it was called, in thermal energy. And I that usually gets noted in economic histories. But because I was thinking of it in environmental terms, I think that really puts the choice very clearly, right? Since 1938, Germany had really been in a mode where it was almost feverishly trying to develop hydropower and hydropower resources, both within the Reich and in conquered territories. And I guess you could see the Speer decision as sort of a confirmation that this had been a bad decision. And that, he shifts at that point from these projects that take longer time to build dams to the immediacy of fossil fuels. And so you see, even within National Socialist energy policy, there is this struggle between hydraulic power, renewable power, and fossil fuel power.
Yeah, that's quite a unique insight. I never really thought of the role that it played within the Nazi plan. I guess the hydropower and harnessing white coal in the region was good in the long-term history of Austria, but maybe a short-term miscalculation of the importance or the role it would play in the war at the time.
Yeah, and it seems almost, like you said, compared to the scale of the crimes committed, it seems, I hesitate to really try to say, well, this was a, this was a mistake, and if they had done this and that, but I do see it as more evidence of just a complete misguidance, and sort of, yeah, what it does show is sort of at least crystallizes the thinking that was going on at the time. Yeah, I do think it's important to understand that this was for large parts of the National Socialist governance that was interested in energy, that this was on their mind.
A little bit earlier, you mentioned the United States and the Marshall Plan. Those ideas really come into play following World War II. Could you explain what the Marshall Plan was and how the story of harnessing white coal in the Alps developed following the end of World War II?
Sure. And yes, so as an environmental historian, I have to have a familiarity with economic history and technological history, political history. So I wouldn't consider myself, an expert on the Marshall Plan. But, I had to have a general understanding of it. But essentially, looking around Europe a few years after the Second World War, it was clear that economic recovery was sort of maddeningly, frustratingly not really progressing the way that the United States had expected and that many European countries had expected. And this was in a large part because of the destruction wrought by the Second World War. So you really had just lots of economic resources had just been wiped out. And you also had a situation from the United States' point of view in 1947, there was a developing Cold War with the Soviet Union. There was a question in many European countries about, you know, what their future political situation would look like. Would they actually want to sort of join the Western powers and create states that were similar in terms of political economy, liberal capitalistic democracies, or, you know, the Soviet Union? And there was real questions. There was strong communist parties in many European countries. And so the Marshall Plan then grows out of the idea of George C. Marshall, Secretary of State of the United States, that an economic program was needed to stimulate the European economy, but also to more firmly embed them in the capitalist world, and to do so by using American economic aid to force cooperation between European states and create economic growth. So there's definitely economic aspects to the Marshall Plan. There are political aspects. It was absolutely needs to be seen, you know, in the context of the Cold War and the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. But this idea is mentioned in the spring of 1947, and immediately there's clear interest all over Europe to access this American aid, including in Austria. And so the Marshall Plan ends up running from 1948 to 1952, some 4 years. And, you know, many people look at it as maybe the most successful economic aid program in history. You know, there's debates about exactly how it helped the European economy and different states and how crucial it was in the recovery of Europe and the eventual sort of economic miracles that take place all over Europe. But I think it's hard to argue that it was not effective and important. So thinking about Austria in particular, Austria was in a unique, somewhat unique situation, similar to Germany in that it was under four-power occupation at this point in time. And you had a situation where the Soviet Union had been taking large amounts of economic resources out of Eastern Austria, in particular, where the Soviet zone was, the occupation zone. And so Austria's economy was also very much lagging still in 1947. And so when Marshall announced this idea to give aid to the different countries, Austrian officials are immediately on board. And all of the countries were supposed to come up with their own priorities. And eventually then they met together in Paris to discuss these priorities. Austria had a number of them, of course, but the one that I'm most interested in was Alpine water. So they saw developing more white coal and particularly finishing the Kaprun dams as one of the most important aspects, one of the most important things that Marshall aid could do, because the Austrians at that point really lacked currency and financing for such large scale projects. And so there are historians who study this and have argued that, you know, without the Marshall Plan aid, the Kaprun dams probably would have taken at least a decade longer if they were built at all. And so I think in this respect, it's very, very easy to show the decisive importance of Marshall aid for Austria. The way that I've sort of framed it in my research is, in the case of Austria, helping Austria to finish the Kaprun dams and some other projects, what we see is the United States, motivated by Cold War rivalry with Soviet Union, essentially helps Austria and finances Austria's transition to a high energy society. So these funds help Austria to make this transition to join this group of countries, we often use the word the West, concentrated in the West, that are just harnessing and generating so much more energy than prior to the transition to fossil fuels. And so that's kind of how I try to reframe the Marshall Plan in these environmental terms, that it was this one superpower helping Austria to make this transition, and all of the advantages and disadvantages that come with that, right? It is, the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s are a story of economic expansion in Austria. Some people look back at these as golden years, right? When the economy was really humming. But at the same, this came at a cost. This came at a cost of modifying large swaths of the ecosystem in the Alps and other places, right? And has brought with us many of the problems, the environmental problems that we confront nowadays.
I think that was fantastic. And kind of looking back on everything that you've mentioned, it seems like there has always been a reason to harness the white coal in Austria, starting with the Industrial Revolution and then further drives after the reshaping of territory after World War I, the Nazis requiring it to help fuel the war, the U.S. then looking to foster influence and reconstruction during the Cold War, and even today with the higher energy usage due to things like AI and quantum computing and cryptocurrencies even, which require super high energy outputs. Mm-hmm. All in all, looking at everything that you studied putting this book together, what are the key ideas or takeaways that you got and you would hope others take from this book, from this story?
Yeah, so I would just say, the key takeaways, broadly speaking, that energy, is fundamental to all, all of our societies, right? And so learning about energy history, I think, is a really good way to get at sort of core insights into the history of different places, because it really is at the base of all of our activity. So that's a broad one. In general, I want to argue that the energy systems that we all live in also have a big impact on how we perceive our environments and how we look at nature. And right, it's only in an era of intensive fossil fuel use and the technology that's brought that, people were able to look at the Alps differently and see white coal and see, places where dams could be built to store the water. So energy really kind of impacts how we perceive the environment around us. And then I think it's important to sort of recognize that our ideas about nature and energy impact how we modify the world. And this gets back to this idea that, right, humans made choices in the 19th and 20th century that we wanted energy systems that we had a lot of control over and that we could manipulate so we had energy when and where we wanted. But as I said, an alternative way to think about things would be to try to think about, well, how can we adapt our behavior so that, we are using energy when it's available and where it's available, rather than transporting it, for instance. And, this happened practically in Austria and still does in a lot of ways. But in the immediate aftermath of the First World War, because coal was so scarce, there were laws that were passed in Austria that shops had to close at certain points on the weekend, right? And so, this is something very small scale, but we could think about things like that, about, can we adjust the way that we live that would be more sort of in rhythm with the natural availability of energy sources like solar, like wind, like water power. So that, I would say those, would be the broad ideas. And then in general, by telling this more or less well-known story about how the Alps have been transformed, I think we see new perspectives on European history. with National Socialism and the post-war period in Austria, right? By tracing the changes in the landscape, we get a little bit of a different perspective on these eras in Austria. And so I would just, in general, argue that environmental history is a good way to get new perspectives on eras and places where we think we've learned basically everything that there could be to know about them. And then finally is to, you know, so the takeaway is to understand that, yes, these choices that we've made with energy, they've created real wealth, opportunity for lots of people, but they came at the cost of environmental changes. And so if we look at the Alps, we see an entire natural biome that has been completely modified to store water. There's a statistic, they believe that something like 5% of the water that drains out of the Alps annually can be stored in the dams that were created in the time period that I look at. So that's a huge, huge modification that's been made and that has had huge repercussions for the ecosystem. I haven't talked about it much, but it's played havoc with fish species and fish migration, to name sort of a popular animal that people notice. But it really goes down to the microscopic level as well in terms of modifying the ecosystem of the Alps that then reverberates throughout Europe, so that these choices have come with environmental costs that have been real and important. And we basically created a new landscape in the middle of Europe and new environmental conditions. And yeah, we're now having to react to the changes that have been made, right, with climate change and global warming on the horizon, and really with us in many ways. People are now wondering, you know, what is the future of alpine water? If we want to shift to away from fossil fuels, we would seem to need more renewable energy. So that could mean a future with more alpine dams. Another issue is the fact that global warming is melting glaciers. So how is that going to affect energy production in the Alps? It might be that as precipitation gets more irregular, which is what most climate scientists believe will happen, some people might sort of be convinced by the argument that we need more and higher dams to store the water, not just for energy, but for drinking, for irrigation. And so I guess the last point I'd want to make is that this story is a continuing one. It is not one where the mountain battery has been created and that's that. New environmental conditions have been created and humans will continue to react to those and make changes based on their beliefs in the present day.
Well, Mark, I first want to say thank you again for taking the time to be on the podcast. I think that your book and the story itself, maybe on the surface level, you think, oh, hydropower in the Alps, harnessing alpine water, it's a pretty straightforward story. But this has been a longer podcast than normal because there's just so many aspects and facets of history that it connects to and that play an important role in the story, or important stories that it connects to itself. It also makes a really good case for the field of environmental history in general. As you say, it's a continuing process, and a lot of history, people try to put a happy start and end to those stories, but this is an ongoing one, and I really appreciated it. And there's a lot more that we weren't able to get to in this time that you can find in the book, Mountain Battery, the Alps, Water and Power in the Fossil Fuel Age. Before we go, could you just let listeners know where they can find the book?
It's available through Stanford University Press. So you could go directly to their website. That's the publisher, but also should be available most places that you're able to get books as well.
And it will be in the link in the description as well. Thank you again, Mark.
Thank you, Luke. This was fun.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Remember to check the episode description to find more from our guest. Follow us on social media or turn on notifications to get alerts for future episodes. The Botschdieber Institute for Austrian American Studies promotes an understanding of the historic relationship between the United States and Austria, including the lands of the former Habsburg Empire, by awarding grants and fellowships, organizing lectures and conferences, and publishing the Journal of Austrian American History. We engage with a broader public audience through digital programming, including videos, podcasts, and blog posts. Auf Wiedersehen, and see you next time.